for him because he's got a hearing aid on. And
I sure will.
I'm a little deaf. I got a hearing aid here, and I might have to turn it up a little bit.
Okay. Okay. We are here in the home of Robert Eads and John Mack Eads, and it is August 8th, 2010. We're in Seward, Alaska, and my name is Rachel Mason. With me here are Shannon Kovac and Karen Brewster, and we're here to hear a little bit about the lives of Bob and Mack. And I'm going to start with Mack, because he's the oldest, I understand, of them.
I'll be 91 in November.
Okay, that was my first question. When were you born? Where did you grow up?
Born in Valentine, Nebraska. We grew up there, went through high school, and then I went to California.
Okay.
After I got out of school.
Okay.
But first I spent, did you ever hear of the CCCs?
Yes.
Well, I was spent a year and a half in there, and I was a truck driver and a cat skinner, or a caterpillar operator.
Where did you work for the CCC?
We had a camp at the Migratory Waterfowl Refuge there in south of Valentine, about 30 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a large refuge, and I spent a lot of time building fire breaks there because it's prairie country, and they had to have fire breaks for prairie fires. Then I spent a lot of time on a drag line digging potholes for ducks.
I would
dig holes in the marshes there that would be about 50 feet wide and 200 feet long and 4 feet deep, and they'd fill up with water. Then the ducks would nest around there.
Really?
And the government would feed them with corn.
Why did they want to feed those ducks?
They wanted to increase the population.
For duck hunters?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, and, you know, I was back there about 5 years ago, and I went out to that refuge, and I can still see those holes. They're still used by the ducks.
No kidding?
Yeah, 50 years later.
Uh-huh. Well, that was a great service.
Yeah.
And so why did you end up in California?
When I went to California, I got a job driving a bus, and in my spare time, I was a special officer at a fight arena, and on the weekends, I was a lifeguard at Muscle Beach in Santa Monica.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. What was that like?
The worst fight there was fighting the girls off.
Oh, off you.
Tough duty,
lots
huh?
Lots of girls.
Yeah. Yeah, what an assignment, being a lifeguard.
But, you know, we were the first ones to instigate the real method of pulling a lifeguard in with a customer. If we'd go out and get a customer, we used to just pull them in, swim them in.
Uh-huh.
But we rigged up a deal where the lifeguard would take a buoy out with him and take a little small line off of a reel on the beach that would work like this, you know?
Yeah.
And then when we'd get a hold of somebody, the other lifeguards just reel us in like a fish.
Oh, great. Well, when did you go into the service?
I was inducted into the service in Colorado. A friend of mine went to Colorado to stay with his sister.
I see.
Because he said, if they induct us in California, they'll send us to New Jersey, and we'll never see California again. But if we go to Colorado and get inducted here, they'll send us right back to California. And that's exactly what they did.
Really?
I was inducted the second day of December 1941, just a few days before Pearl Harbor. Then I was sent to Fort Bliss New Mexico, El Paso, mm-hmm. El Paso, Texas. That's where it was. And we were only there just until Pearl Harbor. Then we were immediately shipped to back to California.
Wow. What do you remember when you heard about Pearl Harbor?
Yes, I do.
What happened then?
Well, it was Sunday morning, and I was just getting dressed to go into town. Me and a friend was going to go visit El Paso. And the first sergeant came in the tent there where I was dressing. He says, you take all those civilian clothes and throw them away. He says, we're at war. I said, what happened? And he told me that about Pearl Harbor. I could hardly believe it, but it was true. And from then on, I never saw a bit of civilian clothes till 1945 when I got out of the Army.
Where did they
Rachel,
send you?
Can we take a pause for a second?
Yeah. I forgot where we were. Oh,
Pearl Harbor.
You just heard about Pearl Harbor, and where did they send you then?
They sent us out to Camp Robertson, California, which is near Paso Robles, California.
Okay.
Just north of San Francisco. Is it north of San Francisco? No, north of Santa Barbara. Uh-huh. South of San Francisco, yeah. About midway between. Camp Roberts was a huge, huge training camp for inductees.
I see.
And I went through training there in a heavy weapons outfit for... I was a machine gunner on a 50 caliber machine gun.
Oh.
And that's where I was when I was sent to the Aleutians. I was in that, I spent some time in Fort Lewis, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Then after a few months there, then we were shipped up to the Aleutian Island.
Okay. And where did you go in the Aleutians?
Island called Omnak.
Okay.
And that's the next island out from Onalaska Island.
Yes.
Past Dutch Harbor.
Yeah.
And there was a huge installation there. And they had, there was a harbor there called Chernovsky Bay.
Uh-huh.
Which is not far from Omnak, but it was a very sheltered harbor. And that's where they unloaded all the cargo to go to Omnak for 40,000 men. And they pulled me out of the infantry there because I had my 201 file from the CCC camp followed me through the Army, and they saw that I had experience on Caterpillar engines.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these boats had Caterpillar engines in them, so I was put on there as a chief engineer on about a 100-foot boat, and I immediately went from a buck private to a master sergeant in one day.
Really?
In one day.
That's good.
Because the job carried that rating.
Uh-huh.
So that's what, then I spent the whole rest of my Army time in the Aleutians, all and around the North Pacific, even going to Seattle a couple of times on boats.
How long did you stay at Chernovsky Bay?
I was around Chernovsky Bay there 2 years.
Really? Oh, okay. Where did you stay? While you were there?
On my boat.
Oh, you had a boat?
Oh, yeah, on the boat I was on, at living quarters for 9 men.
I see.
And I was not only the engineer, I was also the gunner. We had a 50 caliber machine gun up on top of the wheelhouse, and I was also the gunner.
Did you ever have to shoot the gun?
Oh, we practiced every month. We had to, it was mandated that we go through the routine once a month. So that if you did have to use it, you knew what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to my getting onto the boats, I was still in the infantry on Omnak there. And when the Japanese attacked, they pulled us out of the infantry, all the gunners that had experience, and put us on 20-millimeter Oerlikon guns that they had taken off of the Liberty ships and installed around this runway. They had quite a squadron of P-40s there. And when the Japanese attack with these Zeros off of the aircraft carriers, they were out south of the Aleutians or somewhere in the fog. I don't know how they found us, but they did. And they attacked there, and they immediately sent up these P-40s after them. And they were eager to get after them.
Uh-huh.
And they were flying around there and firing at each other. And, of course, we were infantrymen. We didn't know one airplane from another. You know, we couldn't tell. But our pilots soon found out that they were outflown and outgunned and outmaneuvered by these Zeros. And they couldn't do anything with them except they would get them on their tail and bring them down over the runway where we could shoot at them.
Mm-hmm.
We thought the Americans were chasing the Japanese.
Oh.
We didn't have any idea that an American would be running away from a Japanese
airplane.
No. But So here they come down over the runway, one right after another, and we're shooting at this first airplane out there, but we're hitting the back ones. We were hitting the zeros.
Uh-huh.
We didn't know that. We had no experience on shooting what they call deflection shooting, you know, and no experience on that whatsoever. And we had tracers that I could see when I was firing that gun. I could see those tracers going toward that airplane I was shooting at, but it seemed like they were curving off like this and going toward the back airplane.
Oh.
And so then I thought, well, I better take a lead on these guys. But then I thought, well, maybe we better find out which airplane's which.
Yeah, really? We didn't so know. You were actually shooting at the Americans?
Well, what happened there that was of note was the fact that we shot down the very first intact Zero that the U.S. got in World War II, the very first one.
Uh-huh, that's good.
We shot that guy's oil line off of his engine, and his engine quit, so he glided across on that path there and lit on the south end of on Alaska Island in a marsh there in the tundra. The plane landed and flipped over. It didn't damage the plane any, but it broke his neck, so he couldn't destroy the airplane. Oh. It killed him.
Uh-huh.
In 3 days, the Navy had a barge in there, and the Seabees took that airplane intact to Dutch Harbor, dismantled it, and either flew it or just shipped it back to Wright Field in Ohio. There it was reassembled and they had the first intact Zero that they could examine and find out what they were up against.
Wow.
And they did find it. The first thing they found out that this Zero had no paint on it. So they painted it the same with the same paint that they painted the American planes with, the OD paint, found out that they lost about 15 miles an hour of airspeed just from the paint.
Oh.
So after that, they never painted another fighter plane.
Mm-hmm. So they learned something from it.
They found out right quick about that.
Hmm.
They also flew that Zero from Wright Field to California. And at that time, they had all these air raid wardens that would look up in the sky at every airplane. This plane flew all the way from Wright Field to California. Nobody ever identified it as a Japanese plane.
Oh.
Of course, the Americans, they put the white star and everything on it, you know.
Now, was that while you were in UMNAC that you were shooting at those zeros?
Mm-hmm. Then after this attack, I went back into my original company there, and that's when they pulled me out of the infantry and put me on a boat over at Chernofsky.
Oh, okay.
And I was there for 2 years.
Was there a ranch operating in Chernofsky too? What happened to the ranch during the war?
It kept operating all the time, and
really?
we supplied them. We'd put barges of feed and stuff in there with the sheep ranch, what it was.
Mm-hmm.
No cattle.
Yeah, because I know some people from Kashiga, a native village here, who worked at the ranch, but they got sent to Southeast Alaska during the war. But did you have much time on land at the ranch or anywhere around Chernofsky?
Oh, well, we went ashore sometimes, but we were also sent around to Makushin Bay. You know where that is?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, we were sent around there one time just to fish. The mm-hmm. captain was on my boat was a native Alaskan, and he was a good fisherman.
Oh, what was his name?
His name was John Huff, H-O-F-F.
Uh-huh.
Johnny Huff, he's a real experienced boatman. He's dead now, mm-hmm. but he was a really good, and the military sent him around there to catch the pink salmon were running.
Uh-huh.
And we caught tons and tons and tons of them and put them on our boat, took them to Chernofsky, then to put them on ice, that ice machines there, we put them on ice and took them to the installation in UMNAC, and they all had fresh fish.
No. Oh. What did you usually eat?
Pardon?
What did you usually eat at UMNAC?
Well, on our boat, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
We had regular meals. We had a cook aboard, and he was a good cook.
Mm-hmm.
We lived just like you would in a house.
Oh, good.
So, at Chernofsky, there was a flight of Canadian P-40s were flying from, I believe they took off from Cold Bay, mm-hmm. and they were coming out to Omnac. Mm-hmm. They were all Canadian.
Yeah.
There was four of them in this flight. And they all flew in right into a ridge just right above them. Cushion Bay killed all the pilots, and the planes bounced up and over and on the turmoil. Wow. But we were sent over there to go up, get the bodies and bring mm-hmm. them back. But as far as I know, the planes are still laying there.
Really? Did you find the bodies of the,
oh, yeah.
the crew?
Found all of them. And mm-hmm. we had a grave crew with us to take care of them.
Yeah. Know. Did you bury the dead if they?
No, we brought them into Omnac and they were shipped back to, the bodies were embalmed and shipped back to Canada. Mm. It was a real supply of cargo ships, Liberty mm-hmm. ships coming into Cernoski. Lots of times we were unloading four ships at one time.
Wow.
There was a dock on the west side of Cernoski, there was a dock on the east side. That would accommodate a Liberty ship.
Mm-hmm.
And we had anchorages out in the bay where we'd unload them. With everything that went from Cernoski to Omnac went by barges, and we uh-huh. towed those barges over.
Oh.
Okay. Hundreds and hundreds of barges.
Take a pause.
Hey, yeah.
We're back in business.
We're back in business. So how many of you were on those boats?
There was nine in the crew.
There's nine in the crew?
Yeah.
And how did you get along with your fellow soldiers?
Very well, very yeah. well. Yeah, we were all pretty close. Now, we depended on each other. So everybody in the crew had a job, and they did it well. And we had no complaints.
Mm-hmm.
There was some of the boats that had captains on them that were not really qualified. And I've had some experience being on with those guys. But they soon learned and got into just like anybody else, but in a new job, you know.
What was your captain like?
My captain was a native, and he had been on boats all of his life.
Mm-hmm.
He never did anything else but
no.
fish on boats, so he was boat wise.
But that was that John Hoff. That
John
you
Hoff. Yeah.
Where was he from? Anyway?
King Cove.
Well, King Cove. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No, that's interesting.
He's the one that introduced me to my wife.
That's very but interesting.
It was here. She was here in Seward at the time, and she was working on the dock as a longshoreman,
mm-hmm.
and she was also taking care of her younger brother and younger sister. So she was a pretty competent person then.
Mm-hmm.
She was a longshoreman.
Yeah, she
Your
was.
Your wife worked as a longshoreman?
Yeah, my wife worked as a longshoreman.
Here in Seward?
Yeah.
I didn't know women did those jobs
yeah.
back in those days.
During the war, they had a lot of women working on the dock. She was a jitney driver. They had little jitneys, like little four-wheel tractors, mm-hmm. and they towed little cars behind them like a train. And when they'd come under the ship would unload cargo right on these little carts to take them into the warehouse. That's the way they handle cargo then.
Oh.
Everything's in containers now.
I
but
see.
You never saw a container then. The only container that was on those ships, remember those containers that had the liquor or something mm-hmm. on them? They had box that contained liquor.
Oh.
They guarded that very closely.
Yeah.
The longshoremen were the best thieves you ever seen in your life.
Really?
Oh, they could walk right by a There could be a case of whiskey sitting there. A guy could walk by there and slit that corner open, get a bottle out of there, and never miss a step.
Now, you didn't learn this from your wife, did you? That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
So, I guess that's getting ahead of ourselves, but I'm very interested to know how you came to Seward. Did you come to visit John?
The boat John and I were on, we were sent around to the south side of Unalaska Island on a mission there that was pretty risky.
Uh-huh.
We had to put the bow of our beach on the bow of our boat on the beach there and pump fuel to an outpost, a weather station we had out there.
No.
It was Cape Prominence was the
okay.
name of the place. Okay. we had to set our boat on the beach, and it was pounding in the surf all the time. And these are wooden boats I'm talking about. And we damaged the underneath, about the first 30 feet of the planking were shattered. Man, we were leaking like a sieve.
Wow.
And John there had the a colonel on board. He was with us. And he asked him to sign the logbook to cover this operation.
Mm-hmm.
And the colonel did. So we damaged the boat so bad that when we got back to Sadowski, we just barely keep up with the pumps. So we, the divers there went underneath and put a tarp and stuff on there and what they call a soft patch.
Mm-hmm.
Kept enough water out so we could come from there into Seward to the ship. They had a shipyard here where they could haul that boat out and
work.
Well, when we got here, we had to get in line. It took us 6 months before we ever got to the, we never even got to the shipyard.
Oh, really?
But we were just laying in the harbor.
Uh-huh.
And so I asked the officer in charge here, Colonel Johnson, if I could get me a job to up in town here doing something. He said, sure. So I got a job running a generating plant here.
Oh.
They had a water line run right by this house. Came down out of this canyon, right down to the shore there, and they had a 100-kilowatt generator there.
And that was during the war? What year was
mm-hmm.
that?
That was during the war. That would be in 1943, I think.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, it must have been pretty wild here with all the military
stationed
here, too.
The riots were pretty common down at the down at the Yukon Bar.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, I spent a lot of time, I was running that generator at night, and I was this company also owned the phone service in town here.
Mm-hmm.
There were 60 phones in town at the time, and I was the night operator, besides.
Mm-hmm.
I was the phone operator.
Okay.
Sometimes I'd get 3 or 4 calls.
Wow. You were pretty busy.
But most of the time I was with the generator, and they had a backup diesel generator there in case the wheel went down, which it did. This is a real bad water supply up here for generation of
mm-hmm.
any kind because the water's so dirty.
Yeah.
The spruce needles and the leaves and whatever they couldn't strain out would get into the nozzle and plug it up. And it was a fight with it all the time. So we had to shut it down and clean it and start up the diesel generator. But at that time, there was 2 light companies in town. This was the one I worked for was the Seward Light and Power. And the other one was the Seward Electric. One of the city was called Seward Electric. This one was called Seward Light. But they used the same poles and wires and stuff. They got along good. Because neither one of them had enough generation to supply the whole town anyhow. It took about 300 kilowatts to supply the town. We could only supply 200 at the most. So they worked well together, and eventually the city bought this plant. But that was long after I left here.
What were the other guys on your boat doing all those 6 months?
Oh, they were, most of them were put on other boats.
Oh, I see.
But the key personnel on the boats, the captain, the 2 engineers, and 1 mate, they kept on that boat.
Uh-huh.
The deckhands and the cooks and stuff, they assigned to other boats.
Okay.
But at one time in that 6 months, they assigned me to another boat. The engineer wanted to take it to Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
I engineered a boat down to Seattle, and they sent me back by steamship.
Oh. Well, you were busy during those times.
Yeah.
So was that when John Hoff introduced you to your future wife?
Yeah.
During that time?
He introduced me
so
to
she
her.
Was working.
We were married here in 1943, lived here all the time.
Since then?
We had 3 children, and they all grew up here. My adult 1 daughter is here now. My other daughter died a couple of years ago from a brain tumor.
Oh.
My son lives in Anchorage. So, the family's still around.
Yeah. So You got married, but you were still in the Army?
In the service,
when you were still in the service?
But when I did that, I rented a house, and I could come home and live at home while I was in the service here. I was on this boat, but nothing to do on the boat because I had got into the shipyard.
Mm-hmm.
But after we got the boat repaired, then we went back out to the Aleutian Islands.
I see. But leaving your new bride.
Yeah, she was here working on the dock, and I was out working on my boat.
That's right. So where did you go after you went back to the Aleutians?
I went back out to the Aleutian Islands, and then they assigned me to a larger boat.
Mm-hmm.
And this larger boat was a 150-footer, and it was a freight, what they called an FP boat, freight and passenger boat. And we went all over the North Pacific, down to Juneau and up to Nome and up to all over with that one, with freight and passengers.
Mm-hmm.
But our main job was hauling USO troops around.
Oh.
USO troops were entertaining the troops, you know, and we'd haul loads around, and that was pretty good duty.
That must have been fun. Yeah, what a great duty. First a lifeguard, then the USO
troops. That was pretty good duty.
Who were some of the entertainers that came on there?
There wasn't any, no headliners that I can remember that were prominent people, but I know, I remember one time that Ingrid Bergman was here at Seward.
Oh, gee.
Yeah. My wife talked to her.
Really?
But I wasn't here at the time. She was.
How did your wife encounter her?
At a, some kind of a doings that they were, she was raising money for the troops, and my wife was working in the same project, projects, you know.
I see. I understand. So were the USO entertainers, were they mostly singers or?
Mostly singers, And some of them were magicians. You know?
Oh, really?
And some of them were acrobats.
Uh-huh.
Most of them were singers. So, and they were good singers. I thought they were excellent.
I bet.
Because I was no judge.
Yeah. Well, then, so where all would you take them?
I remember taking one to Juneau, one troop we took from here. We picked them up here in Seward, took them to Juneau first, then brought them back to Yakutat, and then to Cordova, and then to Valdez, then to Kodiak, back to Seward.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went away somewhere.
That's interesting. Did you ever take them out to Dutch Harbor or Adak? Or,
yeah, some out there too, but I remember we took one troop to one USO troop to Umnak.
Mm-hmm.
That was after I'd left there.
I see. And how long did you do that USO gig?
Oh, we probably did that for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
But then we were assigned to a burial unit. We had a grave unit come on board, and we went around to all the installations and I picked up the bodies of soldiers that had died,
been
shot, or been whatever, but they were dead. And we had to go, like we picked them up at Kodiak and Cordova, Valdez, Middleton Island. I remember going out to Middleton Island, picked up two bodies.
So they weren't necessarily war casualties.
No, they were just casualties.
Died.
They just died, and some of them had a lot of people commit suicide, you know, just like they do now.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of military suicides right now.
Yeah.
And it was a lot then.
There were a lot then, too, huh?
Yeah.
And there was some killed in arguments, some of them drowned. Quite a few of them were drowned.
Yeah.
We had one of our crew drowned in Kodiak one night.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
He got drunk and didn't come back to the boat. We didn't know where he went, but the next morning at low tide, he was hanging on one of the cross members of the dock.
Oh, he fell into the boat.
Pretty sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how long did you do that?
We were on that grave detail for, I would say, about at least 4 or 5 months.
Mm. So after you picked up the bodies, where would you take them?
The grave crew they were already embalmed.
Oh, okay.
We'd just take them and put them in hermetically sealed caskets.
Uh-huh.
When we had the caskets in the hold,
I see.
Then we would take all the caskets into Whittier, and they were put on a train and sent to Anchorage, and either buried in Anchorage or sent back home or
sent
whatever.
Back to their...
Whatever the army did, you know.
Uh-huh.
But the registration, grave registration people, are very, very accurate on keeping records of soldiers that died. They had
mm-hmm.
their dog tags, and they knew all the particulars about them, and
mm-hmm.
they would, families would be notified, and they were very particular about grave registration.
Yeah.
They didn't even do that in combat.
Oh, huh. That's good.
Yeah.
Did you ever pick up any Japanese bodies?
No, I missed that deal out in the battle out in Attu, which was the biggest battle of the Aleutian.
Yeah.
The battle in Kiska turned out to be the Japanese had all gone by the time the Americans and the Canadians landed on Kiska. But that was a sad thing there, too, because the Americans landed on one side of Kiska, Canadians land on the other side, and they're approaching each other, and they think they're approaching the enemy. Both of them, they got into a fight there and killed about 50.
Oh.
About 50 people were killed. There's a big plaque on it right at the end of the dock there on Kiska Island right now
mm-hmm.
commemorating that thing.
Yeah.
Were you ever out there?
I've never been out there. I'm working on getting out to Attu because I'm working on a project out there.
At Atka?
Yeah.
We spent, Bob and I spent a lot, quite a bit of time. We spent another 4 years in the Aleutian Islands after the war.
You and Bob?
Yeah.
Huh.
On our own boat.
Oh, okay. What were you doing then?
We spent quite a bit of time around that.
No.
We had, after the war, and this is, it was like going to my own funeral, coming back to Schenoski Bay 20 years after the war was over. The moss is growing on the docks. The cables are hanging down and falling to pieces. The docks are kind of leaning a little bit. And the Quonset huts are all caved in. And
so there was some structures left over from
yes.
World War
II. It was just like going to my own funeral when we went back to Schenoski, because Bob and I spent quite a bit of time in there with our own boat.
Yeah.
Because we salvaged some winches and stuff there.
Uh-huh.
But in any case... So,
just back to the grave detail.
Yeah.
Did you ever pick up anybody you knew, or was there any
just our crew members?
Uh huh. Oh yeah.
The getting back to the later time we went out to Kiska, we had a charter
mm-hmm.
with a scrap company that were scrapping out the Aleutian Islands.
Oh, after the war.
After the war.
Uh-huh.
This is 20 years after,
mm-hmm.
1957.
Really?
We worked 1957, 58, 59, 60.
Oh, okay.
Those 4 years, we worked. We'd leave here in April and get back in December, so we spent quite a bit of time out there.
And so this was a project to get rid of all the scrap metal and scrap...
Non-ferrous.
Okay.
They were interested mainly in non-ferrous, like copper, brass, aluminum, and stuff like that.
Salvaging it for...
Well, you wouldn't believe the amount of copper was out in the Aleutian Islands.
Really?
You take a installation of 40,000 men, they all had light poles and wires and generators, and this company had come in and saw those poles down just like... forest and a tree with chainsaws.
Yeah.
All right over. Then they'd bust the insulators off, gather the wire together, wind it up in donuts. And it would be about 900 pounds each roll. Well, Bob and I hauled hundreds and hundreds of tons of that copper wire from different places into ADAC, where it was transshipped down to Tacoma, where it was processed.
That's right. Well, can I ask that we get you out of the war first, and then I'll hear Bob's story of the war, and then we'll hear the story of the two of you.
That's about all I did.
Oh, that's all you did. Okay.
Just run around on a boat.
You got out of the service. How did you get out of the service?
like I told you, when the bomb hit Hiroshima,
yes.
this captain went right to Whittier,
mm-hmm.
and we docked that boat, and we all were put on a train and sent to Anchorage and discharged.
Oh, really? And then went home from there?
Yeah, you know, that bomb was dropped in August of 45, and October the 2nd, I was out of the Army.
Okay.
So did they just figure that was the end of the war?
Pardon?
You were discharged because they were like, that's it, war's over?
Yeah, I was discharged in Anchorage. Then I came home to right, here. I came to Seward, and I've been here ever since.
That was convenient for you,
yeah.
that you were in Whittier
yeah.
when it happened. And what were you doing in Whittier when that?
Well, that's where the boats all docked, and then
uh-huh.
We went from Whittier to Anchorage on a train.
I see. So, okay.
But that was 1945, and then Bob came up in 1946 and married my wife's sister, and then we went into business together, and in 52 we got our own boat.
Okay. Well, great. Now I want to start focusing on Bob and get your story from the war, and then maybe the two of you can tell me about what you did after the war.
Okay.
So Bob, I assume you grew up in Valentine, Nebraska as well.
Yeah.
What year were you born?
1921.
Okay.
We were all of us children there were born at home.
Mm-hmm.
Home born.
And what position were you in the family?
I'm the tail end.
You're the tail end? How
yeah.
many of you were there?
There was three brothers, and we had one sister, which she's gone now.
Mm-hmm. So Max, the second child? Or was there
he's
two
the
brothers?
Third. Yeah.
He's the third one,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, our sister was the oldest, and...
Okay.
And our other brother is in Valentine there now.
Okay. And then, and so you two are the youngest ones
yeah.
in the family.
Uh-huh.
All right. What did you do when you, how did you get into the service, I guess is my first question.
In the military?
Mm-hmm.
I volunteered. I was too young to... join on my own. I had to get my parents' permission to go down and join up, and I did that. They signed the papers, and that was in December of 41.
Was that after Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, about 2 to 3 days.
Oh, okay. So that was why you decided to join the service?
Uh-huh.
Is after Pearl Harbor you enlisted?
So we got signed up for the Army. It was the Army Air Corps then. It was still the Army, but it was anyhow. It was sent to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, for induction.
Mm-hmm.
Physical and an induction. Then from there, I went to Shepherd Field, Texas,
mm-hmm.
Which is it was pretty good. It was a brand new field, and it was the home of around 50,000 on that one base there.
Was your brother already in the military?
Yeah, he was up here by that time.
Okay.
And by the time I got inducted and went to Shepherd Field, Texas, there I went to signed up for all anything had to do with the airplane.
Uh-huh.
I signed up for waist gunner, for A&E mechanic, and pilot training and everything. And I went through the A&E school, which is aircraft engine, and I graduated out of that quite a bit later. And then just before I was assigned to go anyplace, well, they called me in for pilot training. So then I went through the pilot training. It took about 6 months to do that. And then we were trained for twin engine,
mm-hmm.
multi-engine.
Was that a trained for fighting?
Well, they didn't say then. There was they had single. If you went into single engine, you was almost surely being fighters. But multi-engine could be bombers or air transport or whatever. But I got a multi-engine certificate for that, and then we took training in twin engine, and after we got our wings, then we went to Kansas City, Kansas, for transition into C-47s. And that's what I flew for the rest of the war there.
Well, and what are C-47s? What is?
Well, they're a DC-3.
Uh huh.
They're a cargo.
Okay.
And paratroop.
Okay.
Carriers.
So that was your job, was to carry the paratroopers.
And tow gliders.
Mhm.
And resupply the people that you took in.
Uh huh.
And when we got done with the transition, we spent, I think, 2 weeks to transition on the C-47s, then went to Alliance, Nebraska, to an air base there that formed the group that I stayed in,
mm-hmm.
the 436th Group, and the 81st Squadron. And then from there we went to North Carolina. They were pretty close to Fort Bragg where the paratroopers were.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a continual supply of them to haul around, jump every day, and tow gliders. We went up to the, I think it was, up around Lawrence, Massachusetts, some place up there where they built the gliders.
Oh.
And we'd go up there and take about every fifth or sixth one that they flew or assembled. And then we'd tow them back down to North Carolina, and then we'd practice towing them in combat.
Wow.
Scenarios, you know.
Were you with the same group of guys as you traveled from one place to another in training for?
No, we didn't. Not the paratroopers.
Oh,
no, they were. We never knew of the first name of one paratrooper.
Oh,
we hauled thousands of them.
Wow.
And
but the flight crew you worked with, it was always the same guys in the flight crew.
Not particularly. They switch them around, mm-hmm. you know.
Did you ever,
it wasn't like a bomber group where they got where the pilot and co-pilot and everybody knew everybody and never all their family and all that, you know. We didn't do that.
What about your commanding officers? Were they the same all the time?
Yeah, the commanding officers were the same, and the medical officers and mm-hmm. everything. So.
Your pilot group was always the same.
Yeah, the pilot group stayed pretty much the same.
Did you get along with those guys?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you had to.
Oh.
But they didn't last forever either.
Oh. So where were you sent to?
Well, from North Carolina, we left the continental United States Christmas Day of 43,
mm-hmm.
and then we flew south, down through South America, and then from South America we flew across the Atlantic to Africa, and then from there we flew up from Africa full length up to Great Britain.
Wow.
And then from there we were in training for the invasion.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And we had, at that time, we were just towing one glider. Then for the invasion, they rigged us up to tow two gliders.
And by the invasion, you mean D-Day?
Yeah, Normandy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Can I interrupt and ask about the gliders and
what the idea
was behind those?
They were CG-4 gliders. They were airborne infantry that we hauled, and also hauled equipment and food and all, and jeeps. We put a jeep in one of them.
Wow.
What were the gliders used for?
Well, mostly they were for resupply and paratroopers. The paratroopers also rode in our plane.
They'd fly in more troops on the gliders?
Yeah.
And was the idea of the glider was it was quieter than flying a plane in behind enemy lines?
No, you could haul more with one airplane.
Did they go in behind enemy lines then?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were. And we also carried 8 parapack.
What's that?
Tubes. Well, they were under the wings. Dropped them like bombs, but they were full of ammo and
food,
fuel,
uh-huh.
and food,
yeah,
rations, K rations.
Yeah. Wow. And were you in communication with the troops on the ground? Like, did you know whether they got there okay?
Well, yeah, you could see. We took the gliders in at 500 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got rid of them, then we pulled up to 1,000 feet and jumped the troopers out.
Hmm.
And then we left.
Yeah, that...
Up in the lowlands up in the Netherlands, we... our whole outfit there took in 38,000 paratroopers in there.
Did your plane ever get shot at?
Yeah, all the time.
No. Oh.
Everybody shooting at them.
Yeah, and did you lose any of the cargo planes?
Oh yeah, they never had bulletproof tanks or anything in them, and they were.
No, that sounds pretty dangerous.
They were. When we. Went up in the lowlands up in the Netherlands there that was, we put, I think it was about 40,000 troops in there and 5,000 gliders.
Wow.
So it was one of the big airborne invasions there outside of the Normandy.
Mm-hmm. So you flew. You were based in Great Britain, but you flew to Normandy. You flew to the Netherlands. Did you fly to other places in Europe?
Oh yeah, we right after we liberated Paris, it was in August.
Yeah,
we flew back to England and got our act together there, and flew down to Gibraltar. And the Mediterranean, and then we flew to Italy, and then from Italy we made the southern France invasion.
Oh.
There was the same scenario. It took riders in and paratroopers and wing drops and stuff like that, you know.
Do you have any memories of D-Day? What happened? What you were doing on D-Day?
Oh yeah.
What happened then?
Well, that was at night.
Yeah.
But it was well lit up with explosions of all kinds, and it was we flew past Normandy, and then turned around, and came back this way, so we dropped everybody. In that area.
Could you see what was happening on the ground?
I couldn't see anything.
Oh.
No, this was at midnight.
Uh-huh.
And this was midnight before the invasion.
I see.
The invasion happened the next morning. So we had to put those paratroopers in there so they could secure certain installations mm-hmm. of roads and bridges and everything.
Yeah.
So.
And after you dropped them off, did you have any way to know what it
was? No, we didn't linger.
Yeah.
we left and went back to England.
Oh, okay. And what did you do once you were back in England?
Just loaded up and went back the next day.
Uh-huh.
And then the next day, and the next day, and the next day.
And each time you went back, you dropped more paratroopers?
No, we was resupplying them with ammo and gasoline. And
he was in 7 major invasions.
Wow.
South Africa, Sicily, Italy, and come back around for the Normandy. Then he was in the Netherlands. Then he was in the Battle of the Bulge.
Wow.
Then he was in the Rhine invasion.
Uh-huh.
He made 7 different invasions without getting killed. It's amazing.
That is amazing. It lived to tell the story.
I don't know.
So you were always flying your plane over enemy territory?
Yeah.
You always had to fly around into enemy territory?
Yeah.
No, he just flew up. And
there was somebody shooting at him all the time.
Yeah. Can you tell us about some of the close calls you had?
Well, I got... There's many of them. That, main thing was I was never shot down.
That's, yeah. You managed to...
got shot up and not down.
No, that's good.
Yeah.
They come back in tatters.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, every time.
But you always managed to get back to your home field, huh?
We did.
Yeah.
Our commanding officer went up in the lowlands, as we call them up there.
In the Netherlands?
He got shot up in the middle and knocked all of his control cables off, and he had to fly into Brussels just with his engines.
Uh-huh.
And
there's a book down there called The Green Light.
Yeah.
That's all about him and his people.
Oh, and the
paratroopers.
Oh.
Bob is written up in that book.
There's a part about Bob. Oh yeah, and I see it.
Can you hold it up again?
Oh sure. Okay. Yeah, I can see the author signed it and.
Martin Wolf.
Martin Wolf. Yeah,
I see the picture of his airplane on the back.
That's your airplane?
Yeah. Well, similar.
Oh, what a thing.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
They used them before the war for airliners.
Yeah.
But when we had them, they were all gutted out inside and had a big door in the side of the ass end of the plane, about half the size of that hole there. You could drive a...
It's about 6 feet wide?
Yeah, you could drive a Jeep out. It would take a Jeep in and put ramps down and drive them out.
And why do they call it green light?
When you turn the switch on in the cockpit, it lit up a green light in the Astrodome. And also in the cargo plane, that was an indication for all the paratroopers. They were all hooked up to get the hell out of there.
Ready to jump.
Oh, gee.
When the green light came on, they were hooked up to the static line and ready to jump.
Yeah, wow. Did you have any rituals that you went through every time you started out on one of these
missions? We had to go to briefing.
Uh-huh.
We get up early in the morning and go down and get briefed to where we're going to go and what we're going to do and what we're going to haul. And
they flew in great groups, you know.
Yeah.
This wasn't him. That was Hundreds of airplanes.
Okay, so all of you together would, every pilot would get together and get briefed?
They'd take sections of them, like the morning flight and noon flight and the afternoon flight and the evening flight. They'd all have their own briefings.
I see. And then did you have any superstitions about what I don't know,
for safety,
to protect you along the way?
No, nothing.
You had to rely on yourself.
Yeah, just on yourself.
Your own skill.
Yeah.
Like that operation went up in the lowlands up there. We took off in the morning about 7. It was just getting daylight, and when we made our trip in there, dumped our stuff out and came back with our in our gliders and stuff, they were still taking off from that same airfield or around there.
When he got back, the airplane still taking off on that same mission.
There were so many of them.
Same. We had to...
Thousands of airplanes.
Then we had to go to it again for 2 weeks.
So you would just fly constantly, fly out, come back, resupply, go out again.
Yeah. By the time we got back, they'd have us loaded up. And by the time they got back, they'd done the same thing. And then...
Oh.
So our sorties would be probably in that one 24-hour period, it'd be probably 1,200 sorties.
You must have lost some friends among the pilots.
Oh, yeah. We got pretty well decimated in that operation.
What was your morale like?
It was high.
It was?
The barracks that I was in, we had 24 pilots and navigators, and by the end of that mission there, which was about 2 weeks, there was 12 of us left.
Half gone. That's a lot. We've lost.
You just something you had to do.
Yeah. You just kept going. And were you writing letters home during this time?
Once in a while.
Not to me.
Not to you.
He wrote to me. Yeah, I'd get letters out from him when I was out in the Aleutian Islands.
Yeah, what did you tell your family about what you were doing?
Not very much. It was all censored.
You couldn't tell anybody anything.
I see.
If they had censored it, they just... cut, you had a razor pant, razors, and they just cut, they'd get a letter full of holes. So you didn't say anything.
True for you? Did your letters get censored?
Same way.
No, because they didn't want you to say where you were.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we've run out of tape on this one.
Run out of